Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for this program. This is another in our ongoing series, The Weekend Reviews. A DVD hit the ground running yesterday. It's titled Surviving the Mob. This is a documentary about ex-Gambino crime family member Andrew DiDonato. It is chilling stuff indeed. Andrew DiDonato is my guest today. Andrew, it is great to have you on the program.
It's great to be here, Simon. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I have watched Surviving the Mob more than once, and each time I do, I get something new that I missed on the previous time, and it just gives me the chills. Your life story is not for the squeamish. What made you decide to make this documentary?
Well, to be honest with you, I never set out to do something like this. I remember I signed out of a witness protection program a few years back, and I had some close family people to me and friends of mine, and they had seen what it had done to me and some friends throughout the years. I lost a lot of friends here. I had some family members who were killed, and it's just very, very sobering stuff. And when we look on TV and we see what's portrayed and how these guys are glamorized or, considered folk heroes and such like that, I guess I started to listen to the chatter in the background from the people who cared for me that maybe I should try to reach out to the youth and give back a little bit after all these years of my life of taking, because that's what organized crime is. You take from society always. It might have been a good chance for me to open the eyes of somebody, just one person, not going to change the world, but one person whom I can't change my past, but I could change somebody's future or mold their future, hopefully, with this documentary. So, and it was just to give people the truth, like the brutal realities, is like I like to call it, and to let them see how the family structure really is, how, this ain't The Sopranos where you wipe the blood off at the end of the day and everybody goes and has a drink and celebrates the episode they just shot. And just to show that people cry real tears and people's lives are ruined forever. And, I buried my first friend at 18 years old and you don't come back from that. And This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to show that.
Are you at all concerned that by coming out of the closet, you might incur the wrath of some of your old associates?
Well, I look at it this way, Simon. Before I became a government witness, I was in the street like everybody else, and I was on the run the last 17 months of my organized crime existence, I should say. And when the law finally caught up with me, my own crime family wanted me dead. And I look at it this way. There's no different levels of dead. They wanted me dead then, doing this and opening the eyes to people as to how this really, what really goes on. I have a healthy respect for the game to know that I'm always going to be in some sort of danger. And I accept that. But if I don't get that word out, then I do what everybody else in society has done over the years and let organized crime continue to intimidate people's actions. And I can't have that. So if it's ever going to come a day where my friends or ex-friends, if you want to call them, or colleagues, are going to catch up with me, well, then so be it. And I'm not trying to be a martyr here. I'm just trying to say that I'm not going to let anybody else control my life. That Gambino crime family controlled my life, all of my life. I didn't make a conscious decision on my own until I decided to become a government witness in 1997. So when I look back upon that, that's kind of pathetic, that every decision I ever made before that was with the approval of my immediate crew leader. And now I took back my life. So
right.
That's, and I'm willing, to me, you can't put a price on that.
I think Two Real Productions, the company that has put this new DVD together have done just a bang-up job. The style they've used is incredibly minimalistic. It's you and a camera. There are no experts weighing in. There are no distractions. There's just the occasional photograph that pops up, you know, when you're talking about a person or a situation. Is this how you wanted the documentary done?
Yeah, at first what we did was we threw a few ideas out there. First we started off with the typical Q&A way to go. And then we decided, listen, what I'm trying to do here is show the people the sobering aspects of this life. And I didn't want it to take away from it by all the bells and whistles with this expert or show this, you know, this landmark or show this or play fancy music in the background. What we wanted to do was keep it one-on-one, me with the public. Let them see how I started out, where it was jovial and how I thought I was a part of something great and how I had, my mind was shaped at an early age of 15, 16 years old, that this was an honor to be involved in this. And then as I show the viewer how it changed and how I had started losing friends and family members and how the respect only goes up the ladder but doesn't come back down, and how it's a narcissistic existence that the bosses will put you in uncompromising positions in every turn that they can, and they control you for so long, and they give you one or two options. Either do what you're told or eat your own arm and become the thing that you were indoctrinated to hate your whole life. And I thought that this was the only way to get the message across, and I believe it worked because it let people see the truth.
I think it makes for a very, very powerful vehicle. I mean, that there is nothing to distract you. That there is Andrew, there's a couch, there's a camera, and Andrew tells his story. I mean, it's one of the best DVDs or best documentaries I've seen in a very, very long time. I mean, I think you and Two Real Productions really deserve great credit.
Well, I appreciate that, Simon, because, you know, when somebody such as yourself who, you know, has been around and, you know, you're in the media and you could see, you get your hands on such material such as books and documentaries and movies and things come across your desk, and to know that I got the message at the point across the way that I wanted to makes me feel good inside, knowing that possibly down the line somebody could benefit from this. And, you know, and to me that is, it's a great feeling to finally, you know, take a lifetime of pain in which I caused, and I like to look back upon it and call it like the runaway train that my life had become, and use it now for positive things. And it's really, really, really nice. It's nice to hear, you know. And I think what the most that people get out of this is that I left a bit of a part of myself on that film, and people could see it. And there was no cuts or major edits. The only edits that these guys did was they edited to put pictures in. Other than that, that was just me putting it out there. And I think once viewers see it, they'll understand the pain that I caused my family and the pain that I caused myself and everything else like that. And they'll see that there are no happy endings in organized crime. No matter how lucrative the money you made was, or how can I say it, or how you think, you know, you're up on this pedestal. It's not. At the end of the day, you got three options. You spend the rest of your life in prison, and or you get found in the street dead, or you become a government witness and you still lose everything you ever had. So there's no happy ending.
Right. No happy ending whatsoever. I mean, the DVD is 90 minutes long. That's a long time to talk. I mean, obviously, you didn't shoot it in a single session. How long did it actually take to shoot?
Well, I'll be honest with you. We had did a number of different aspects of it to see which would be the best fit. So it took us a number of months, actually, to take what we thought would be the best approach. But as far as shooting the incident, we did the particular, what you see on film, we did in like a two-day time period, truthfully. Because what I did was just go out there and put it out there that I started my life in crime at a very young age, which I did. I come from a neighborhood that was entrenched in organized crime. You know, so it was a normal behavior for the area. So when I was a very little boy, my father was in federal prison. And it wasn't uncommon for you and three or four of your other friends for them not to have fathers as well. So when you grow up around this and all of your friends of your family are people who are living on what you might call the fringes of society, you know, you grow up with certain values and you're taught at an early age that these are accepted behaviors. Not saying that I didn't come from good parenting or good family, because I had a very loving family, very caring family. But these things were normal within our lives. So I grew up
differently. I'm not sure if it's on the DVD or if this is something that we spoke about offline. When you visited your father, but you had no clue it was a prison.
I didn't, because you know I was a very young boy, Simon. And with that said, I was a very young boy, and I was told that my father worked in a hospital. Unbeknownst to me, it was a federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. Now, when you go there as a child, if you don't see no big guarded gates or, correction officers at the gate with guns, how are you supposed to know? So I go up, and everything looks nice and clean when I walk in. Everybody's kind to me because I'm a child. And then my father, everybody's dressed in uniform. So as a kid, you just think that's normal. And I remember it very vaguely, but not too recently when I decided to do the project that I start going through some of my family's memorabilia, and I seen, you know, some letters and cards and stuff that I drew for my father as a kid on, you know, with crayons and paper, how I, you know, Dad, I love you, I miss you, you know, can't wait to see you type things. And, you know, it brings back a lot of memories. And a lot of them, you know, when you're younger, you don't realize what you missed out on. I didn't have a father the first 5 or 6 years of my life, you know, and it's tough.
Oh, yeah. You started into crime at a pretty early age. How did you actually get involved with the Gambino family?
Well, it's funny you said that, because if history would have been a little bit different, chances are I would have been involved with the Genovese crime family. What had happened was my uncle, great-uncle of mine, his name was Patty Maccaroli, he was a captain in the Genovese crime family, and he was murdered in 1978. I was a 12-year-old boy, and we had already moved to the Canarsie section of Brooklyn. I was raised in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, but at this time we had already moved to the Canarsie section. Now, both areas were entrenched in organized crime, and then after my uncle passed away and was murdered, a few months later, my cousin Johnny was also murdered, gangland style. And it devastated my family. And I was young. I didn't know that my uncle was a gangster. I just knew that my uncle was a very respected figure within my family. And I knew that he was something special to everybody. And I seen how it affected my family. And how I remember as a child that my Uncle Patty seemed to be the only person my father ever truly talked with respect. And being that him and my mother were divorced when I was an early age, plus he was away for all those years, I craved my father's attention like any child would. And when I was living in this other neighborhood, there was kids I was playing with whose fathers were already in organized crime families. And we started, you know, just robbing minimal stuff, you know, wheels and tires off cars, front and back bumpers off cars, car radios, doing like burglaries and stuff like that. And it just so happens that one or two of their fathers happened to be involved with the Gambino crime family. And by then, my uncle was dead. And it all came to roost for me. I was like 15, 16 years old. Me and a friend of mine were shaking down these kids who were robbing this bagel distributorship that they worked for. And it just so happens that we were approached by members of the Nicholas Carrazzo faction of the Gambino crime family and told that these particular guys who we were targeting had owed them money for gambling debts that we were to back away. And, of course, we knew who Nicky was because I was really good friends with Nicky's nephews at the time. And I still was stupid, young, and I thought that, you know, I wasn't going to back away. I had no other way to make money. And I wound up getting arrested for it. And when I got arrested for it, a few days after I got out of jail on bail, I was approached by Nicky to come and visit him at the social club. And when I did, he explained to me that he knew my activities in the street. I was already committing crimes with people that he knew, kids that came to see him already, and that if I ever had a problem in the street, I had the green light to come to him for help. If I had any stolen property or anything I wanted to get rid of, I could also use his connections to do so, that I had a friend there now if I needed one. And from that day on, it just opened up this whole new world for me. I don't think high school was out the window. I mean, I started full time from that moment on, committing crimes every day. This was my new home, and I felt as though I was a part of something great. I thought this guy walked on water, you know what I mean? And you don't realize till you start getting older and start getting some mud on you that it's just a vicious, vicious life.
Okay, you said something that I think needs explaining. You were invited to visit him at the social club. What was the social club?
Well, what happened was Nicky had this place. The social club is a gathering. It's a place where organized crime guys would gather. They play cards. They exchange, information with each other within the family. Messages could be sent to these places if they need to get in touch with certain guys within the family. And it's a place where guys would eat lunch together or dinners with each other. And just that friendship, that camaraderie that brings guys closer. But in this life, there are no true friends. So I think people need to see that. It's just a bunch of guys who are criminals who are using each other to help get them to the next level. And I was invited to the social club, and back then you thought, oh my God, this was something great, you know. I had heard throughout all the years when I was a kid how special my uncle was. Now I'm a little older, I could understand my uncle's position within the Genovese family before his passing, and I thought that this was going to be, I was being accepted into the fold. And when I went there, now I was a part of this greater entity and accepted. And it just, every day we would meet, and he told me, and it's so funny how he explained it to me because I was that young. He said, listen, kid, this is like school. He says, you don't miss, because if you miss, you can miss valuable lessons here. He says, every week we're here to exchange information, goods, whatever it may be. He says, and maybe one day somebody here may need you, and if you're not here, you're not being a good friend. So if you want to learn something, or if you want to see, and you want to get the best of this friendship, you be here every week. I never forget that.
There's a wonderful, wonderful story that you tell on the DVD, and it would be amusing were it not for the seriousness of it. You boosted a Mercedes with a doctor's bag in it. Do you want to retell that one for us?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, it seems to be everybody's favorite when I start to speak about it, but I could have laughed about it now, thank God, but at the time, I was a very young boy. I was about 17, 18 years old. Like that, I was a greenhorn. We were in the car business, my crew. We would chop shops and everything. And so we had a friend of ours. We used to go to these mandatory meetings to meet our crew leader, which was Nicholas Carrazzo. So we used to meet him at the diner in different locations or whatever. So we go to meet him at this diner one day. We walk in. Another friend of ours came in behind us and said, hey, you guys are still in the car business? We said, yeah. He said, there's a Mercedes outside running. He said, why don't you guys get it? He says, it's brand new. He says, nobody's in it. So we went outside. We ran outside, and me and two other friends of mine, my friend Mike and me, walked out. Mike said, I'll go in. The guy was on a payphone, and he wasn't paying attention. So I step in front of him so he can't see the car, and Mike runs to the car, gets in, and he hears Mike getting in the car. He turns around and tries to go. I, in turn, throw him like a hockey hip check to get him out of the way. Well, it doesn't deter him too much. He's, like, really clawing for the car at this point. He runs, he grabs the door handle, he gets dragged like 4 or 5 feet. Mike gets away. I run to the work car, and I follow home. Well, business as usual, right? You figure it's business as usual. So I get home, and we get the car, and usually what we do is we look through the car when we get it, and we call our contact to let them know we had a Mercedes, and if they needed us to drop it at a certain location, and et cetera, et cetera. No sooner than we in the house, we go downstairs, and we find a doctor's bag in the trunk of the car. We get the doctor's bag, and we bring it upstairs. We don't think anything of it at the time. We find such unusual stuff in people's vehicles over the years, you can't even imagine. So I open up the doctor's bag, and no sooner than I open up the doctor's bag, my phone rings. When my phone rings, I answer it, and it's my crew leader, Nicholas Carrazzo. He says, "Hey, kid." I said, "Yeah, Nick." He goes, "You still got that thing you took from the diner?" I said, "Yeah, of course." He says, "Well, listen to me, kid. There's a little bit of a problem." He says, "And I can't speak to you over the phone about it." He said, "But whatever you do, don't touch that car. Leave it where it is. I'll call you back in a few minutes, and we'll take care of it." I said, "Okay." I hang up the phone. I look through the doctor's bag, and I open up. On top of the doctor's bag, there's a .38 caliber pistol. Take the pistol, I put it on the side. I was like, "My God." I look through the bag, and the bag is stuffed with envelopes. So I open up the first envelope, $1,500. I look at my friends, okay. I look at the second envelope, $2,000. Third envelope, $2,000. $3,000, $1,500, $500. We're going through these envelopes like crazy, and there's money in every one of them. All of a sudden, the phone rings again. "Hey, kid, yeah, listen. In that car is a doctor's bag." And I'm, "Yeah, Nick." "Whatever you do, don't open up that fucking doctor's bag. Excuse my language." "Okay, Nick." I says, "Okay, Nick." As soon as I hang up the phone, what do you think we do? We start digging more through the doctor's bag. You know, we're kids. Next thing we know, after all was said and done, $87,000 in cash.
Wow.
Phone rings one more time. Says, "Kid, in that bag there's a ledger book. Whatever you do, kid, do not lose that fucking ledger book, and don't you dare look in it." "All right, Nick, you got it." Click. Start looking through the book. Names, numbers, money, the whole bit. So with this said, we're saying, we got to figure get to the bottom of this. So we go downstairs back to the car. We look in the glove box. We take the insurance card out or whatever, and we see it says Bart Castellano. Saying, "Bart Castellano. Bart Castellano." And the license plate said Bart 1. So we're saying, who the fuck is Bart? We don't know, but we're not thinking right away. All of a sudden, we go upstairs and I say, "Castellano. Can't be. Can't be." We look through the wallet, look through the thing, and we see a picture of Bart with these two young girls and this old man. I'm looking at the old man. My friend looks at the old man, and all of a sudden, I had 100 heart attacks. It's Paul Castellano in the picture. Now, if anybody knows who Paul Castellano was in the mid-'80s, he was the boss of our family. Well, I said, "Jesus Christ, we can't be this unlucky. How unlucky could one guy be?" So no sooner than we said that, the doorbell rings. And my next-door neighbor, who lived on my block, his name was Joseph Carrazzo, who was the nephew of my crew leader. As a matter of fact, he's a lawyer today, and we call him house counsel. He's a lawyer for the Gambino crime family. And he says to me, he says, listen, I just got a phone call. You guys got something here that belongs to my father's friends?" So we laugh. They say, "Joe, we know whose car it is. You could say his name." Joe was even afraid to say his name. And we started laughing. So now we're sitting here as kids, and we know we're in trouble. But now, as kids, you still want to think, how are you going to get to keep this money? We're brainstorming how we could still try to keep this money. Well, after all was said and done, the following day we made an appointment with them to give back the money, of course. And our boss told us, he said, "Listen," he goes, "kid, never in a million years would I tell you to return anything in the street that you stole." He says, "Now you know that it's good politics that you return this." He said, "If the President of the United States had something and you stole it, you wouldn't have to return it. But with this guy, you have to return it. You understand how that works?" I said, "Yes, sir." And we gave it. We gave it back. I took the bullets out of the gun. And don't forget, I took the bullets out of his gun when I returned it back to them. And we went there loaded up. We said, you know what? We didn't know if our lives were in danger, if they were going to make examples out of us, nothing. But we remember going back there the next day when we returned the items to say, hey. And the funny thing is that with all this money he had no gas in his car. So we took out $10 out of the money to buy gas. We told him, listen, the only money missing is the $10 in gas. And he took it, and he went on his way. And now we were kind of mad because we felt slighted. This guy is our fearless leader. He's our boss. And he knows we're in the street. We're scrapping and scraping. We're kids. We didn't even get like a fine, this fee or nothing. And we felt, you know, upset about it. So with this said, he wound up sending us a basket of fruit and said, thank you very much for, you did a very honorable thing. Your friend Paul, blah, 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 and we were told by Nikki that we had a feather in our cap now and a favor coming if we need it. So the long joke was, yeah, I need a favor. Tell me I need that $87,000 back. And we just made light of it, but it could have very easily went the other way.
Oh, yeah.
Very easily.
Oh,
and
what?
I think people need to understand that, you know, we had a good contact. Nikki was a very respected man within the Gambino crime family, and I think that had a lot to do with the outcome. I think that it was because Nikki was so Johnny on the spot to be able to reach out and get the money back in a timely fashion, and there was no horse playing around, and he seen that, you know, we were serious guys. But we called in that favor numerous times, Simon, because we were always in trouble. You know what I mean? We were always in trouble. But, you know, I look back on it and I can laugh, but I know many people who didn't have happy endings when stuff like that happened.
Oh, I could see you getting yourself in a pile of trouble, you know, over that escapade.
Oh, without a doubt. And within a few months later, Paul Castellano was dead, and we always said to each other, not making light of his death, of course, but we always said that, you know, if we would have known this, if we would have been privy to that information, that was going to happen, we would have hit out for a few months and got to keep the money. But then, as protocol would, you know, come in, John Gotti would have wanted the money, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway.
Right. Yeah. I've talked to you on several occasions, both on the air and off the air. I've also talked with Frank Collada. Although you and Frank are very different, I do see some parallels. A fierce loyalty to your organizations, but it was a one-way journey. They weren't loyal back to you when the chips came down.
Well, you know, with that statement, Simon, I think that this is what people need to see. You know, the respect goes nothing but up the ladder. And I maybe years and years ago, when it was a different era or a different time, maybe it was different. But in today's mafia or organized crime or whatever you want to put a name to it, it isn't that way. You see, it's a greedy, selfish existence and a narcissistic one at that, where I can put you in any compromising position and I control you your whole life. So you're going to conform whether you like it or not. I know I'm being unfair to you as your boss, but you have two choices. Either you adapt or you turn into the thing that you've been raised to hate the most. And it's really, really, people need to see that there's no people skills at the top of the ladder. There's none. All it is take, take, take. And in the mob, you're only as good as your last favor. You can make money for these people 24/7 for 20 years straight. But if you cost them money once, you'll never even see it coming. It's amazing. It's amazing. And me, I was brought up old school. And what I mean by that is that I was brought up, you take a 30-year sentence on the chin, and that's it. You keep your mouth shut, and you suffer, and that's just the way it goes. But when I was faced with the scenarios that I did, and so many things that built up before I made that decision in 97 to become a government witness, and I seen how it was a one-way street and how I would have walked into a fire for this man, but I couldn't get one winning decision with this guy. And after a while, you start to see it for what it really is. You know, how you give and give, and when you're done giving, and there's nothing left to give, they take all you have left, and that's your life. And that was pretty much the position I was in. You know, I was part of a bank robbery crew making some money, and my boss at the time was kind of throwing out feelers, thinking that I was holding back money that he thought that he should have got a piece of, or whatever the case may be. He had just killed one of my friends over some sort of drug deal that we had got involved with. We robbed a drug dealer. And his decisions, I could see the writing was on the wall for me by some of the things that he was doing. You know, they were telling me to bring my drug dealers aboard so I could, you know, share them with the family, which is, anybody knows anything about organized crime knows that that would never happen. The drug business is considered a dirty business by organized crime circles. And, you know, you could shade it as an extortion, but to actually deal in drugs, that's a no-no up front. Everybody does it, but they do it in the back rooms, so to speak. And now you're telling me to bring these guys forward. Why would you want me to bring my guys forward? Unless you didn't think I was going to be around anymore and you wanted to know who they were so you could take over where I left off. And I seen that. And then with questioning my my take on some certain crimes you thought I was involved in, with other members from other families in which I committed these crimes, sent the alarm bells in my head that I was probably on an oxygen tank as far as my life expectancy. And I felt betrayed, Simon. I felt betrayed because here I was. I gave my life to this life. Literally gave my life. And, you know,
that was pretty much the turning point.
Yeah, it's pretty much the turning point because now you start to say to yourself, wait a minute. Now I'm in a position where I know they want to kill me. I know it. There's no sugarcoating it. I'm fighting all these wars on all these different fronts, and I can't win. Because it isn't like I had a problem with a guy from another crew. Hey, I had a reputation in the street, Simon, as being someone who pulled the trigger. Okay, I could have very easily went out a martyr, you know, went out in a blaze of glory. But when you have a problem with the boss of the family, there's no wins. You cannot win. You cannot win. And now you have to start to think of yourself and say, well, what should I do? Should I throw my life away and start to become, what, this mass murderer to kill all of these guys or try to? There's only one of me. There's hundreds in the family. It's only a matter of time before they get you. So now you throw your life away? For what? No, I'm going to see, for the first time in my life, I'm going to make a decision on my own. And I'm going to see the potential in my own life. And that's what I did. I seen the potential in my own life. That I could do something better. That I could not have to walk that tightrope anymore. And here I am, giving my life to you. And you're going to take my life when I didn't do anything unloyal? Because you thought that maybe I am the only person who could tie you into a murder, or I'm the only person who you think that I'm hiding money from you? You know, it just goes to show that no matter how much you do, it's all political. And if the guy on the top deems you a risk or deems you expendable, you don't have a chance. You do not have a chance.
I do believe that you did some jail time. You were also in the
I did a lot of jail time.
Right, the witness protection program, and you were also one of the witnesses in a fairly significant trial, John Gotti Jr.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I had never had no business. See, the family is very big, and I never had any business dealings with John Jr. None, but my testimony, John had a few co-defendants, and my testimony was against one of the co-defendants. His name was Michael Yannotti. He was a crew member of mine within the Nicholas Carrazzo crew. We were childhood friends, and we had committed too many crimes together to count. And my testimony was against him in the double homicide of two of my other associates and friends of mine who were dear friends of mine. And also, my testimony was to show the conspiracy within my crew to kill John Gotti Jr. Because my boss, who ultimately became the boss of the Gambino crime family, today he's in prison now. He pleaded guilty to those two homicides in which we're speaking about now. And he took over when John Gotti's father went to prison. And the case was significant because, number one, it was significant because I was there laying it all out. My life was an open book, and I was there to set the record straight, because all of these years, these guys are lying. We never had anything to do with drug dealers. We never had anything to do with this, with that. Well, I was the in-between. So I know that's a lie. So I put it all out there. And here I was explaining A to Z what happened. And Mr. Yannotti received a 20-year sentence. And my testimony became law in that case. And Nicholas Carrazzo, who denied any, you know, affiliation with any sort of drugs or drug dealing in 2004, he had made some sort of public statement that he would never be involved in the drug business or anything like that, and he denied the two murders, you know, was all he could muster. But when I came forward as a witness, he got indicted on the charges. He went on America's Most Wanted, and he was a fugitive from justice for a number of months. And then he gave himself in, and as the story would unfold, I was on an airplane, Simon, on my way into New York to testify at his trial. And he took a plea of guilty instead of going to trial. And he got a sweetheart of a deal because it was an old murder, deemed an old murder at that time. It was a 12 or 13-year-old case. And he got a 15-year sentence. Now, he was in his late 60s, early 70s at the time, so by the time he's ready to come out of prison, he'll be in his mid-80s. So I think his organized crime life is over as we speak anyway.
Yeah.
And so all that denying actually came to roost when he admitted guilt to partly on my information. So it gave me the credibility of knowledge of these acts, and it showed that here I was telling you all these years that this happened, and finally that was validated.
Wow. I noticed that the Gambino family is back in the news, and I have to say, I'm absolutely shocked, not because they're back in the news, but the reason they're back in the news. What is the story behind the arrests that were made last week?
Well, from what I know, listen, I haven't been, you know, a part of the everyday activities of the Gambino crime family in a number of years.
Oh, no, and I didn't mean to...
I know that, yes, for sure. But what I'm trying to say is, as far as my take on it, is this. You know, at first, I read some of it in the newspaper, and I know a number of people that are on the indictment. And it seems to me that some of the charges were, you know, your boilerplate organized crime or, you know, racketeering, you know, RICO charges, or so to speak. There was murders on the indictment. I see there's extortion on the indictment. But I also noticed that there was solicitation of minors for prostitution, and that they were actually, I don't know what the exact law is or what the charge was, but it showed that they were prostituting minors. And one of the guys on top of the indictment, his name was Danny Marino. Now, Danny Marino was a well-respected guy within the confines of the Gambino crime family. And while I was in the street doing my dirt, Danny Marino was somebody with whom I would look up to with respect. And I was, believe it or not, I was kind of happy to hear that Danny had nothing to do with that aspect of the indictment, because I knew Danny to always be an old-time, old-school thinking type gangster. But what I do know is that that part of the arrest just goes to show what's left out in the street and the pool or call it the gene pool that the bosses have to choose from today, that predators would be on the same indictment as respected gangsters. And I look at it as this, like when I was in the street in the mid-90s and in the 80s, all through the 80s, these guys wouldn't even be able to have a conversation with us, let alone be a part of the day-to-day activities. Not only that, that if they set up shop where we were, you could rest assured that these guys would have been out of business and probably in the trunk of a car within a week of operations. But now that it's such a high-profile thing, and from my knowledge of being within the family myself and knowing how the way things run, I'm led to believe that being this is such a high-profile scenario where, you know, you have prostitution going on and minors, I would ultimately have to believe that there's nothing that goes on at this high-profile level that the bosses would not know about. So what I'm trying to say is that although somebody in Danny Marino's stature had nothing to do with it, and I'm not singling out Danny at all, I'm just saying that whoever is in charge at this moment or at the top of the totem pole, I would have to believe that although they may have distanced themselves from that particular crime, they knew about it and they just kept their hand out for payment and kept their eyes shut to it just as long as the wheels kept getting greased.
Wow.
Because there's no other way to describe it. How could something like this, because the FBI doesn't just do an investigation on a Monday and arrest you on a Wednesday. So this had to be something that is long running. So in my eyes, and this is my opinion from my life within organized crime, that there's no way in God's green earth that the bosses didn't know that this was going on. But it just goes to show that the boilerplate crimes of years ago, extortion, racketeering, loan sharking, whatever, scams, whatever you want to consider organized crime activity, you could see that due to the constant barrage of indictments and arrests from the FBI and the Organized Crime Task Force throughout New York and throughout the United States, it just goes to show that these guys are adapting and trying to do different things and welcome different things. And as you can see, some of them are not too respectful.
Right.
And this, I think, is just a shame. You know, this is just a shame.
The DVD, Surviving
yes,
the Mob, went on sale yesterday, I believe. So it's probably a little premature to ask how well sales are going, but where can people buy copies?
Well, what I did was Amazon.com. They go on Amazon.com. They could just type it on the top heading, Surviving the Mob, hit the go button, the DVD will come up, and it's very easy access. We put it under the genre of organized crime documentaries as well. If they punch in Gambino Crime Family, it will come up with that heading as well. And if anybody out there wants to see the, how can I say it, how organized crime affects society and the people that were involved in organized crime and everybody around it, it's really an eye-opening documentary. And I don't say this only because I'm involved in it. I say this because I left a part of myself on that screen. And I tell you, I watched it the other day again, because I know that within this life, when you do something like that, of course you have your critics. And I welcome critics because they'll see that I gave everything on that film. And they'll see I left no stone unturned. And that's what I want.
It's a very emotional DVD in parts.
For me it is, because it opened up a lot of old wounds. I had to be reintroduced, so to speak, the scenarios that altered and changed my life. Friends that I lost and buried at the earliest ages of 18. Other friends of mine that I lost, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s, and family members that I lost, and a whole bunch of other scenarios that ultimately altered my life. And I've come to one conclusion, you know, when I put it out there. I'm lucky to be alive, and I know this. and you call it survivor's guilt or whatever it may be, but I felt a part of me owed my friends and family members that I lost throughout the years to make this documentary, to make, let people see this. You know, everybody will have their own take on it, and that's fine. But listen, everything I said there, you could set your watch by it. You know what I mean? And it's very, very emotional for me. Even the other day I watched it and I had to shut it off at the end because it really gets to the heart of how my life was altered.
The one part that really gets to me is the story about driving in a car. You want to deal with a van that you suspect someone has done something bad, and there is some gunfire involved. Clearly, you have a great deal of remorse. The good news is no one died.
Well, basically, that's just it, Simon. See, when you're young and you're a part of this entity and you go out and you're doing these things, and what happens is that whether you detach yourself from the realities of what's really happening or you are believing it so wholeheartedly that you're justified in your actions, whatever it may be, this is who you are at that time. And what had happened was I was standing outside speaking to my crew leader, Nicholas Carrazzo. I was in front of a neighborhood bar in which we ran, and he was sitting in the car. A gentleman was on the corner, and he started firing shots in my direction. One of the shots, first shot, hit the windshield of the car. I shoved Nicky's head down, like below the glove box. A friend of ours, who another crew member, was in the driver's seat. He started to drive away. I, in turn, pulled my pistol out, and I started running towards the individual. The individual ran away. I threw a few shots at him down the block, and I missed him at the particular moment. Due to some investigation work from some other crew members, a day later, we found out who this individual was. And with that, I brought it to Nicky, and I asked him how he wanted to handle this. Now, Nicky was much too smart and much too cunning to sit there and tell you to go and murder somebody. So instead, he just looked me in the eye and just made the sign of the gun with his hand and said, "Teach this guy a lesson." We went out, and we did what we thought was going to be an honorable and respectable piece of work, so to speak, for the family. And we went out, and within 2 days' time or a day's time, a few days, whatever it may have been afterwards, we found this gentleman's location. We rolled up on him. He was in a truck at the time. We rolled up on him, and we just barraged his truck with gunfire. And we drove away, and I remember driving away not knowing had he been dead or alive. And I remember saying, thinking about it, that what was going to happen at that point. You know, I'm thinking 100 million things. My mind's going 1,000,000 miles an hour. And I think, you know, he was hurt on the scene, and, you know, he was shot, and he lived. And I thank God for that today. Because, and that was just one violent incident I was involved in. I was involved with many others. You know, that's just one that we're, you know, pointing out. And I'm not proud of the violence that I was involved in. But it just goes to show that violence is a very accepted part of how things work within organized crime. And I think the bosses dish out the violence because that's the way that they can keep control and show that discipline so people underneath them don't try to stage a coup every so often. They feel that, you know what I mean? That's why it's dished out. And for me, you know, looking back upon it, which I do now constantly, these have a lasting effect on your life. You know, when you realize, after losing friends, of course, and people that, you know, you were involved in hurting in your life, you see your own mortality. And, you know, you live with a lot of guilt over it. You know, I altered other people's lives. I didn't have that right. But yet, when I was living that life, I felt justified in my actions. I felt as though that I was doing the deeds of, how can I say it, of the entity. I was doing something that was going to be looked upon as honorable. And there is no honor in that life. None whatsoever.
The DVD is part of a larger project. You're working with my good buddy, Denny Griffin, on a book. How is that project progressing?
To be honest with you, Simon, working with Dennis is probably one of the greatest things that ever happened with me. I mean, he's a sweetheart of a guy. You know, he became a good friend. He's very straight to the point. As you know, Dennis, he's not a man of very many words, but when he speaks in volume. He really, really knows what he's doing. He took this book in a direction that I could only dreamed of doing on my own. And right now we're almost two-thirds of the way done with the manuscript. And the publishing company has us spotted for a release date of the fall of this year. And I look forward to it. I really do, because the DVD is, you know, to me, a great project. But it just scratches the surface where the book really, really gives people the front seat to my life and gives them that front seat view. That, and it's just amazing when I look back, me and Dennis go over story after story, year after year, and I can't begin to tell you how I'm shocked. Me, I'm shocked at how many crimes I committed and how many people were suffered these consequences, and how many lives were changed, and how many, and you know what, it's something where people have regrets in their lives, Simon, and that's understandable. People regret instances in their lives or decisions that they made. I regret decades. How sad is that?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you look back upon it, and I look at the book as something where it brings closure for me, because I could put these things to rest. And I could dedicate my projects to people and family members that I lost over the years. And I owe them something. I truly do. Because I was right next to them. You know,
the one thing I can guarantee is that Denny will do an absolute wonderful job.
There's no question about it.
He is one of the best crime writers I have ever had the pleasure to meet.
I count myself lucky to have Dennis in my corner to do such a project. He was, like I said, what really opened my eyes with Dennis was that Dennis had already did a previous book about a gentleman you spoke about earlier. His name was Frank Collada. And Dennis did a wonderful job with his project. And I reached out to Dennis for the simple reason is Dennis had worked with a government witness within Frank Collada, and I needed that. I needed somebody who had that track record, who was able to be trusted in that venue, who was going to be able to take the serious nature of my present situation and be able to still cultivate a project and not let it, you know, sidetrack him from what his goals would be. And Dennis was the proper man for the job. And I'm very happy. I really am. And I'm lucky. I'm a very fortunate person right now, Simon, in a lot of ways.
I have to admit that my views on organized crime have really, really changed over the past year. The Hollywood version just does not marry up with reality in any shape or form. You know, sure, there was violence, but it's certainly not like what we see today with the street gangs. You guys actually had, if you will, a code of ethics.
Yeah, well, the code of ethics only goes because we had, I belong to a traditional mafia family. The street gangs are run a little differently. It's like when you go into prison, Simon. When you go into prison, you could have been a boss of a family. You could have been a captain. You could have been whatever your status was in the street. At that point on, you're in a whole different world. That status means absolutely nothing. When you walk into a prison, the only thing that inmates respect is violence. They don't respect who you were. They don't respect where you come from. They don't respect anything. They just want to know one or two things. Are you a punk? Or are you going to stand up for yourself? Period. And the gangs outside those prison walls, that's how they carry themselves. Are you a punk? Or are you going to step up? And their violence is a little bit more, how can I say it, undisciplined. I'll have to say that. It's undisciplined, the violence. But I don't know how these individuals had to live and how they grew up. So I can't make a conscious decision to say A, B, C about them, but I can't say one thing. Yes, organized crime ran things a lot differently and does run things a lot differently. Because organized crime, the bottom line, is about money. It's not about stature with society. Organized crime is a secret society. They don't want stature outside of the life. These drug gang guys, they do everything out of bravado, if you ask me. It's out of bravado more than out of business sense. So there's no structure as far as running it and committing the crimes to get a point across. The crimes are more committed to show, to shock, to horrify, to scare, to use as an intimidation tactic to gain a piece of turf or area. And organized crime does it too, but not as, they're not as quick to do it. They don't do it on as a frequent basis as these gangs do it.
Right. Well, they, as I read it, they keep the man in the street out of the picture.
Yes. Yes. And what this said is that organized crime never wants to upset what you might call the apple cart. If I'm making money, Simon, and we have a big thing going on, and we're making money hand over fist, hand over fist, hand over fist, and somebody within that machine gets out of line, yeah, he might disappear. He might disappear, whatever. There might be a little article about him here or there. But he's not going to be found brutally murdered where it's going to cause an investigation within that part of the operation where it's going to ruin the earning part of it. No way. No way.
Right.
Bosses don't like that. So everything would be on the hush-hush. So although discipline will be dished out, it'll be, they will at least try to put a lid on it where it's held to a minimum for people to recognize that violence is surrounding that activity. Because the money is more important. It's always more important.
We have talked several times, and I get a real sense of regret from you for your past. If you could wind the clock back, would you change your life?
You know what, Simon, I look at it this way. I would change a lot of decisions that I made. But, you know, the most important thing to me was, Simon, to be honest with you, my son. I have a son right now who just turned 23 years old 2 days ago. Okay? I missed the first 5 years of his life. I was home for 30 months after being away the first 5 years. I was home now, 30 months. I spent 17 of them on the run. I could not be there for that boy. Then I went to jail again for more time. Then from jail to a witness program. So I lost so many years of this boy's life that if I had one with Simon, I would go back in time just to be there for him as he needed me. And if it meant throwing my life away again, so be it, just as long as I could have been the father that that kid deserved. Because as we speak about it now, that boy doesn't even know who I am. I'm a stranger to him. And my blood runs through his veins. It's the most saddest depiction of reality that people could see. And do I blame organized crime for it? To a certain extent. But I take responsibilities for my actions as an adult and know that I put myself in the position to have that happen. So I'll take my share of responsibility. And I should have been there.
That's where
I would change my life.
This is a very personal question, and I would not be offended if you don't answer it.
Go ahead.
Do you and your son talk?
No, as a matter of fact, we don't. And to the bottom of that, I'll tell you what. See, that's how embedded in my neighborhood or in my society or where I grew up. That's how much of a stronghold organized crime has on the people within the area. You see, in my neighborhood, what I became is like sacrilegious. It's, you don't become a witness. You don't become that. Because they only are fed the lies of how organized crime really works. Have they been involved like I was, or walked the path that I walked, and have their eyes open to the way things really are, maybe they would see things differently. But they don't. They live in the confines of their 9-to-5 jobs, and they know that they won't step out of line with these particular people because of A, B, C, and D. Now, my ex-wife, who I, you know, we were divorced a number of years now, and she developed friendships with guys and wives with whom I did business with all my life, and she felt as though that she didn't want to leave the area or lose those friendships. So that was a decision that she made. Do I agree with it? Of course not, because my son is in an area and he's within the confounds of places and people with whom, that if their backs were to the wall, they would kill my son very easily, just like the next person. And I live with that every day, that I don't speak to my son. And it's sad, because he's going to need a father. And he's needed a father all these years. And instead, he's sitting there listening to the chatter in the background, and being he never really had a chance to speak to me on these issues and didn't understand how hard to make these decisions were. I just didn't wake up one morning and decide to turn on the only life that I knew, Simon. I didn't do that. And I'd been in and out of jail my whole life, so it wasn't about I couldn't hack it as a man to do my time, because I could have did it gratefully. Jail, I'm no stranger to jail. I got more friends in jail than out. And it wasn't about that. It was about, why would I draw my life away? Where's the honor in that, to protect the same people who, the first legitimate chance they get, are going to try and kill me?
Mm-mm-mm.
And organized crime don't forget. You do 10 years. You think, oh, because you did 10 years, when you come home, you're going to be a hero? No. They're just going to wait 10 years to kill you. And that's how it works. And the ironic part is, I say this in my documentary, is I made this decision thinking that if I would change my life, and now I would have the time to be a father to my son, and, you know, to make up for those years. But you can't make up for those years.
No, you can't.
So, and I made these decisions thinking I'm going to be his dad. And it turns out that they chose the other side, because that's how embedded in society in my neighborhood it is. They should do a survey, Simon. And I think someday they should do like an experiment. They should go into my neighborhood and do like now when you go to different states, they do, you know, where they count all the people in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they see how many people live in the state. They should count how many wives, mothers, sisters are without brothers and husbands in my neighborhood. All you see is single mothers in my neighborhood, because half the population where I come from, either their husbands have been killed or they're in jail on organized crime charges.
Oh, my God.
Because that's what's embedded in my neighborhood. They should do a statistic one day to see how many single moms are out there wheeling baby carriages whose husbands ain't never coming home again.
Wow. I believe that one of the things that you're doing now is giving talks in schools and to other groups. What is the message that you're giving?
Well, see, the whole idea is this. I mean, I could sit here and I could talk to you all day long until I'm blue in the face. But if you don't go out there and make a positive change in your actions, then nobody ever believes that a guy like me could turn his life around. You know, you get that old same cliche saying, a leopard never changes his spots. So you go out there and you got to do it in deed. You can't do it in words. So I go out there and I try to do it in deed. I try, and I do this because I want people to see. Use my experiences. Take them. My life's an open book. Take my experiences. Take it. Learn from it. Learn from it. You may not like the things that I did or things that I stand for. You might not like the fact that I became a witness. You might think that I sold out. Whatever you may think, at the end of the day, you're going to see that if you're really involved in this life, that my decisions to do so were conscious decisions based on my reality of what could have happened and what can happen. And it's to show the normal person that it's not what you see here on the television. It's not what you think it is. Of course, everybody knows organized crime has violence, but they never put a person to this name. I got friends of mine who died. And when you read the news articles, all it says is organized crime figure shot dead. Like he's trash. Okay, you might not have liked it, but he's a human being. He's somebody's father. He's somebody's brother. He's somebody's son. He's a person.
Yep.
I just try to let people identify with the characters, who's around, who runs what, how it really affects it. And listen, like I said, I'm not going to change the world. I'm not. This has been going on for too long. It's going to go on far longer than when I'm long dead. It's going to still be going on. There'll be two other people speaking about this at another juncture. But the bottom line is that I owe it to those people and friends of mine who lost their lives.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I live with that survivor guilt. I live with it. So I want to go out there, and I think, as I owe it to them, go out there and try to do something. Whatever it may be, try. So that's what I do.
Andrew, our time is just about up, but I want to bring some humor into this. I think we need to bring some levity in. I was talking to you yesterday.
Yes, sir.
And I know Denny was in the background, and he asked you to ask me, you know, when I was going to be visiting Las Vegas. Remember that?
Yeah, he said that he would, you know, because he wanted to know when you were going to be visiting him. I think because what happens is Denny has two locations where he lives. He lives in New York State, and he lives in Las Vegas. And he wanted to know what your comings and goings would be to try to see if maybe he can catch up with you in person. Or whatever. I know that he goes back to Las Vegas. He'll be going back to Las Vegas, I think, in November. And I guess he'll try to make those accommodations with you or whatever the case may be. But we laughed about it because I said, if you're in Vegas, what are you going to do anyway with Simon? What are you going to do? You're going to gamble? And
well,
he started laughing. I don't know. Denny's a coffee drinker. I don't think Dennis is a whiskey drinker in any way. He's a coffee drinker. So if you do spend any time with him, Simon, do yourself a favor. Bring plenty of coffee, and if you don't have a big enough coffee cup, get the IV set for him because he drinks more coffee than any person I've ever seen in my life.
No, well, actually, the story I was going to tell you was we shared some emails this morning about a completely different subject. But I made the remark, Denny, you know, it seems to me that, you know, Vegas isn't a safe place. You know, it's full of ex-mobsters and people like you. So he responded with, oh, Vegas is very safe. I'll make sure that Andrew and Frank cover your back.
Well, that's all. And I told Dennis, I said, you know what, this is... I don't, you know, if it's been a long time since I've been in, it's been a long time since I've been in, you know, Vegas settings and casinos and stuff like that. And I told him, I said, listen, I said, if I ever come to you, I says, and I spend a little time at your house and I come as your guest, I says, and we walk down the street together, somebody says to me, hey, I know you, I'm going to say that I'm Dennis Griffin, I told him, and we have a laugh and joke about that. And, I says, you know, if that ever happens, you know, if I'm in wherever I am, you know, because I travel the country now. I go, like today I might be in California, tomorrow I'm in Arizona, the next day I'm in whatever, you know, wherever I'm needed as far as like doing a show like yours or helping law enforcement in any way, because that's what I do now. I help law enforcement to the best of my ability. I try to let them see certain things about organized crime or, you know, something to that nature. and it's always something. So in my travels, I told Dennis, wherever you're with me, from now on, that's what I'm going to say. I'm Dennis Griffin. And he laughs hysterical.
Oh, I can imagine. Andrew, our time is up. I really, really want to thank you for taking time today to talk to us.
It's my pleasure, Simon. It really is. You know, you're a gracious host, and anytime you need me, it's always a fun time for me because it gives me the opportunity to do what the message I'm trying to get out, and plus talking with you and you becoming a fast friend of mine. We've been doing a lot of dealing with each other lately, and it's been a pleasure.
I will give you a word of warning. Pretty soon, I'm going to be pushing you to do a program on the witness protection system.
That's fine. I think that should be shed some light on some people for some myths that people have about the witness program and what it entails. And you know, I'll do it. And I have a lot of respect for the Marshal Service, so I'll put it out there where people know how the structure is. Of course, there's a lot of things that I won't give away out of respect for them. But
right.
For the most part, it will be fulfilling. It won't be anything that people think that, you know, it will be fulfilling. And I think people need to see what it's really about and what it represents, not that it's some sort of welfare program or, you know, you're going to be living this life of luxury now that you became a witness or whatever. People don't realize you still go to jail. You still have to pay your dues. You still have to pay society for whatever ills that you committed. And, you know, it's all about getting a second chance to make the best of your life. And
right,
it's like anything else.
I think many people view it as the ending of John Grissom's great book and movie, The Pelican Brief, right, where there's a Gulfstream jet waiting, you know, and they're going to whisk you and your sack full of cash to some wonderful faraway place. It's not like that, is it?
No, it's not at all. And I think what people need to see is, like I said, it's a legitimate chance for a second chance in life. And it's like anything else. You'll get out of it what you put into it. And if you're not willing to put into it, you're going to fail. And you're going to find yourself alone. You're going to find yourself without the things you need to make a living. And then what good was it? If you're going to go that route, you have to go wholeheartedly, 100% with your mindset that you're going to do the best that you can to make a new life for yourself. And if you're not willing to do that, I don't recommend it for anybody, no matter what their decisions are. I think it's, you know, because let's face it, I had to make those decisions to go that route because I have very high profile scenarios. So there is a no fail factor in my personality. I can't fail. And I've been fortunate enough to open up businesses and able to, you know, make a life for myself. And some people, their stories aren't as happy. I've seen some people that I knew when I was in the street went to the witness program, and they're back in prison now as we speak. And it's sad because, you know, they had the opportunity, and sometimes it doesn't work out. So that's part of my saying is sometimes there's no happy endings, because once you make a deal with organized crime and you're in bed with organized crime or you're a part of that life in any capacity, it's a deal with the devil. And you can't win. There's no winning, Simon.
Indeed. Andrew, I do have to close this. Again, I want to say...
Have a good day, my friend, and I'll speak to you ASAP whenever you'd like, and shoot me an email later. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, you have yourself a great day.
You too, Simon. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, bye.